Good evening. We greet you in the name of Jesus again this evening. Trust you've had a good day. I've enjoyed being with you today and starting to get acquainted with you a little bit, although we don't know very many of you yet. The subject that we're looking at tonight is miracles of the Old Testament. Actually, perhaps before I go into that, maybe I should give just a little bit more introduction. A number of you have been asking some questions. My wife was Ivy Yoder, that was her maiden name, Roy Yoder's daughter, some of you know him, and Sister Esther is an aunt to my wife, and so we have a connection with Ed and Esther. We moved to the Belleville area late summer, to help my wife's parents out. Her mother passed on then shortly after we got here. There was some time that transpired between our decision to move and actually being able to arrive here. So we've been there helping her father since that time. It's been a good experience for our family. We lived in Alaska for 17 years. Back in 2000, we were asked to move up there to help start a church up there. Living in an isolated setting like that, fairly small congregation, you just don't have the broad spectrum of fellowship that you do in a place like Pennsylvania. And so it's refreshing in a way. I think it's good for people to go to far-flung places to spread the word of God, and I encourage that, of course, but at the same time, there's value in larger communities as well that we've come to appreciate. We have seven children. Five of them are with us. Our two oldest sons are getting married this summer. One has been teaching school in Oregon, is putting his roots down there, and then one of them just moved to Arizona. His future father-in-law offered him a job there, and that looked desirable to him, and it'll be good for his health there as well. He struggles some with allergies and sinus issues and so on, so he's in Arizona now. But the rest are at home with us yet, at least for a short time. Our oldest daughter will be leaving to teach school in Columbiana, Ohio this fall. All right, so that gives you a little bit of a picture of our family and where we've been, where we're coming from. All right, miracles of the Old Testament. I wasn't sure what to do with this subject to start with. It's really a broad subject. There are approximately 80 miracles in the Old Testament if you go through and get a list together of them. We see something miraculous right to start with in Genesis chapter 1. Creation is a miraculous manifestation of the power of God. And it carries on through the Old Testament, one miracle after another in relation to quite a few different people. And just to give you a little picture of the miracles of the New Testament, I'm going to read part of the list. I'm not going to go through the entire list. That would get a little bit tedious. But we have creation, we have the flood happening, we have the Tower of Babel where God confused the languages of the people, we have Isaac being conceived miraculously in Abraham and Sarah's old age. Moving on to the children of Israel then, we have God appearing to Moses at the burning bush. The bush was not burned up. Then God gave Moses those indications of the validity of his call, in his rod turning into a serpent, his hand turning leprous and then being healed, and so on. We have the 10 plagues that were brought to the Egyptians. We have the parting of the Red Sea in the wilderness. We have the healing of the bitter waters of Marah. We have the manna from heaven, water from the rock two times. We have God bringing miraculous judgment upon Nadab and Abihu when they offered strange fire. We have the deaths of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, again, a miraculous judgment there. And there were other incidents as well. We have the lifting up of the brazen serpent. People were able to look to the serpent and be healed. We have the parting of the Jordan River. We have the fall of Jericho, the sun and moon standing still. Later on, we have Dagon falling before the ark after the Philistines captured the ark. During the time of the kings, we have the withering of Jeroboam's hand after he set up that idol And the prophet came to pronounce judgment on that. We have the destruction of the altar at the same time. We have Uzziah smitten with leprosy. We have the replenishing of the oil and meal at Zarephath, with the widow of Zarephath, and the raising of her son. The sacrifice that Elijah did with the prophets of Baal there. And also the parting of the Jordan River, both Elijah and Elisha did that. We have water supplied to the armies in Moab. We have the multiplication of the widow's oil, the raising of the Shunammite son, the curing of the deadly pottage. In Jonah, we have Jonah swallowed by a great fish and then released on dry land. No doubt the hand of God was in that very clearly. We have the destruction of Sennacherib's army in Isaiah and the sundial returning 10 degrees. And so the list goes on and on. And then we have all the prophecies yet as well that were made of Christ. And those were fulfilled very accurately. That is another miracle in itself. We don't often think of the prophecies as a miracle, and yet it is a miraculous work of the Spirit of God in the hearts of men to proclaim those things hundreds of years beforehand and to have them fulfilled so accurately. And so that gives us a little glimpse in some of the ways that God used miracles in the Old Testament. And we may wonder, why were there so many miracles in the Old Testament, as well as many miracles that Jesus performed, and miracles among the apostles and some others surrounding them? And today, we don't see nearly as much of that. Miracles still happen, but we hear of them from time to time, and yet they're comparatively rare. And I believe a part of the reason for that is that in Old Testament times in particular, the people did not have the history to refer to that we do today. That history was being made at that time. And those people did not have a lot of, especially written history, to look back at and see the nature of God, and to see the working of God, and to see the power of God, and so on. And I believe that God, I'm not sure exactly what word to use, but God made many of these miracles happen as a confirmation of his nature and of his power, as a confirmation to establish the faith of his people within him. And we have the benefit nowadays of looking back at all of those stories, and those bolster our faith. We don't need as much external confirmation anymore about who God is. And so the purpose of those miracles still goes on in the fact that we can look back on them and we can read them, but at the same time, we don't need exactly the same level of miraculous activity today. Defining a miracle, before we go further, a miracle is an effect or extraordinary event in the physical world that surpasses all known human or natural powers and is ascribed to a supernatural cause. The second definition, such an effect or event manifesting or considered as a work of God. In other words, a miracle is something that supersedes the laws of nature as we understand them. The laws of nature are overridden. The power of man is inadequate to bring this about. And so God is the one who is the performer of the miracle. A few other things in relation to a miracle that we need to recognize. A miracle must be an exception to the normal pattern of events. And I have heard the term miracle misused sometimes, where it's applied to things that we just don't totally understand how they work, and yet there is scientific explanation for those things. For example, a brother used the example of a black cow eating green grass and producing white milk as a miracle. And I understand where he was coming from. It's something marvelous, it's something wonderful, it's really a manifestation of the wonder of God in creation, and yet at the same time we understand the chemical processes that take place as the grass is broken down inside that black cow and white milk is produced. And so that that is not truly a miracle in the true sense of the word. At the same time, we do use the word sometimes for things that are wonderful or that are marvelous. And so in that sense, it would not be an abuse of the word. A miracle involves some kind of theological truth claim, as an act of God would not contradict what God has revealed about himself. In other words, God is saying something about himself in the performance of miracles. And we'll see a little more of that as we go on here. A miracle must also have good moral impact, as God would not violate his standards. God is not going to perform a miracle that in any way contradicts his nature, or that in any way contradicts what his righteousness or what he stands for and what he has revealed to us. Miracles are a temporary suspension of normal patterns. It's not something that goes on and on and on. It's something that is an event that happens that is a suspension of normal patterns by God overriding those things. Let's think a little bit about God's purposes for miracles. One of the purposes God has had for miracles is that they meet a human need. A simple example of that is the manna that God supplied for the children of Israel in the wilderness. They needed food. They needed provisions. And God miraculously provided the provision of manna for them. Now, that was a miracle that went on for a period of time on a daily basis. But once the children of Israel got to the land of Canaan and ate of the first corn after they crossed Jordan, then that miracle was suspended. It was no longer in effect. But one of God's purposes for miracles is to meet human needs. And there, some of the others that I read over in that list would fit in with that as well. Another thing that miracles do, they arrest attention for God. God was trying to get the attention of Pharaoh and the Egyptians with the 10 plagues there. And he sent one miracle after the next, judgmental miracles in that case. But the purpose of those miracles was to arrest their attention, to get them to sit up and take notice that they are dealing with a God here and not just a people. Unfortunately, the Egyptians didn't take that lesson to heart, and so judgment came upon them in a much greater way yet in the Red Sea. But one of the purposes of miracles is to arrest attention for God. Another example of that is Daniel's friends in the fiery furnace, where the Son of God miraculously appeared with them, and it arrested Nebuchadnezzar's attention, and he was ready to seek God, at least in a certain measure after that. Also, another purpose for miracles is they confirm God's message. I already mentioned Moses and his rod and turning into a serpent and the leprous hand. And there are numerous other other miracles as well that would verify that or that would go along the same pattern of thought. One of those is what happened with Jeroboam there, again, when he set up that idol. He was angry with the prophet. He stretched out his hand to grab him, and his hand withered. And then further, the altar fell apart. And so God was confirming the message of that prophet, and Jeroboam ended up fearing and asking the prophet then to help him find healing. Also, they build man's faith. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 11. I'd like to read a few verses from there. God worked many miracles for the children of Israel as he brought them out of Egypt and through the wilderness. And God tells them here in Deuteronomy chapter 11 that the purpose of this is for them to understand his nature and to have faith in him. Deuteronomy chapter 11 and verses 1 to 8. Therefore thou shalt love the Lord thy God and keep his charge and his statutes and his judgments and his commandments alway. And know ye this day, for I speak not with your children, which have not known, and which have not seen the chastisement of the Lord your God, his greatness, his mighty hand, and his stretched out arm, and his miracles, and his acts, which he did in the midst of Egypt, unto Pharaoh the king of Egypt, and unto all his land. And what he did unto the army of Egypt, unto their horses, and to their chariots. How he made the water of the Red Sea to overflow them as they pursued after you. And how the Lord hath destroyed them unto this day, and what he did unto you in the wilderness until ye came into this place, And what he did unto Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, the son of Reuben, how the earth opened her mouth and swallowed them up, and their households and their tents and all the substance that was in their possession in the midst of all Israel. But your eyes have seen all the great acts of the Lord which he did. Therefore shall ye keep all the commandments which I command you this day, that ye may be strong and go in and possess the land whither ye go to possess it. So one of the reasons that God worked all these miracles as he led the children of Israel out of Egypt and through the wilderness was to strengthen their faith so that they would be ready to move forward when the time came to possess Canaan. God knew there would be opposition when they got into Canaan, when they got to Canaan and it was time to take the land. And he wanted their faith to be solid. He wanted their faith to be strong. He wanted them to recognize that they weren't on their own. He wanted them to recognize that God was at work for them, that God was their shield, that God was their defender, that God was the conqueror for them. And so he had demonstrated this time and again in different ways as they traveled through the wilderness. So the building of faith is one of the purposes of miracles. And this deviates just slightly from our subject of miracles of the Old Testament, but in the New Testament, many of the miracles confirm the deity of Christ. And that was a purpose of those many miracles. Acts chapter 2 and verse 22 says, "Ye men of Israel, hear these words, Jesus of Nazareth, a man approved of God among you by miracles and wonders and signs, which God did by him in the midst of you, as ye yourselves also know." A man approved of God among you by miracles and wonders and signs. The miracles which Jesus did were a confirmation of his deity. Now, as we think about miracles, we are awed by them, and rightly so. But at the same time, we need to be aware that to God, a miracle is not a big deal. I don't know how else to word that. To God, in his power, a miracle is not difficult to accomplish. We can illustrate it this way. Suppose there's an ant under a stone by the side of a path where people walk. And this ant would really like to see this stone removed. And so he heaves with all his might on this stone. He tries to move that stone. Maybe he'd like to build his nest under there or whatever might be going through an ant's mind. And he is unable to nudge that stone even a little bit. It's far too heavy for him. And then a man comes walking down that path, and he's just passing the time of day, and he's picking up stones and throwing them at trees or whatever. And he picks up the stone that the ant is under, and he throws that, and he goes on his way. Now, if we can use our imagination a little bit, and I don't mean this in any sacrilegious sense at all, but the ant could look up and think, "Wow, this is a miracle." And to the man, this would be just a totally natural occurrence. And that gives us a little bit of perspective of what it's like in relation to us as ants, so to speak, and God, who is so much greater. What to us is a clear evidence of supernatural power. It overrides the natural laws that we're familiar with. To God is no difficulty at all. And if Genesis chapter 1 verse 1 is true, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth. And if the account of Genesis 1 is true, that God simply spoke and all of these things came to be, then we can only expect that a God of such a nature, a God of such power, a God of such wisdom, will also be reaching into that which he created and at times overriding the natural laws he put into place. And it's no difficulty at all for him to do that because he created those things in the first place. Man occasionally creates something that gets out of his control. Not so with God. God always is well in control of that which he has made. God is able to override the laws of nature that we are bound by. And it is no difficulty for him to do that. I mentioned in the part about faith that God was seeking to build faith in the children of Israel prior to their entrance into Canaan. I invite you now to Joshua chapter 3. I'd like to spend the remainder of the time focusing on one of the miracles that God did and some of the things that we can learn from that account in Joshua chapter 3. The book of Joshua is a book I enjoy very much. It's interesting to notice how many parallels there are between the lives of the children of Israel in the book of Joshua and the life of the Christian, the life we are called to as God's children. We often think of Canaan or the promised land as heaven, and there's a sense in which we can think of it that way, and rightly so. But I believe there's something more here for us as well in the book of Joshua, and that is that Canaan is a type of what it's like for us to enter into the kingdom of God, to enter into the relationship with God, and then to go forward and expand the borders of the kingdom of God and do his work. Canaan isn't altogether just a type of heaven, but also it's a type of living in victory over the enemy and moving forward in Christian service. And I'd like for you to think of it in that sense this evening. And we see evidences for that. We see parallels as we look at the book. In chapter 5, there was the rite of circumcision was reinstated. And God said after that, that now, I can't think of the wording just off the top of my head. No, it was in chapter 3 or chapter 2. Let me find my spot here. Well, I'm not sure where it's at. I'm sorry, it escapes my memory at the moment. But after the circumcision was reinstated, God said, now the defilements of Egypt have been removed from you. That's not an exact quote, but that's the thought. And that is a type of our redemption, the washing away of our sins. And then there were commands to maintain separation from and to utterly destroy the Canaanites. And that's a parallel to what it must be like in our lives as we separate ourselves from all that is evil, and we utterly destroy anything that would hinder our relationship with God. And there were commands to remember God once life became easy. And we need those reminders as well today, especially in the country in which we live with the privileges that we have, that we not forget God. So we can see that's a few of the parallels that we can find in the book of Joshua in relation to what the children of Israel were doing and what God has called us to as well. I'd like to read Joshua chapter 3 right now, starting at verse 1. And Joshua rose early in the morning, and they removed from Shittim and came to Jordan, he and all the children of Israel, and lodged there before they passed over. And it came to pass after 3 days that the officers went through the host, and they commanded the people, saying, when ye see the ark of the covenant of the Lord your God, and the priests and the Levites bearing it, then ye shall remove from your place and go after it. Yet there shall be a space between you and it, about 2,000 cubits by measure. Come not near unto it, that ye may know the way by which ye must go, for ye have not passed this way heretofore. And Joshua said unto the people, sanctify yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you. And Joshua spake unto the priests, saying, take up the ark of the covenant, and pass over before the people. And they took up the ark of the covenant, and went before the people. And the Lord said unto Joshua, this day will I begin to magnify thee in the sight of all Israel, that they may know that as I was with Moses, so I will be with thee. There we have one of the purposes for the miracle that occurred in this chapter. And thou shalt command the priests that bear the ark of the covenant, saying, when ye are come to the brink of the water of Jordan, ye shall stand still in Jordan. And Joshua said unto the children of Israel, come hither and hear the words of the Lord your God. And Joshua said, hereby ye shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will without fail drive out from before you the Canaanites, and the Hittites, and the Hivites, and the Perizzites, and the Girgashites, and the Amorites, and the Jebusites. Behold, the ark of the covenant of the Lord of all the earth passeth over before you into Jordan. Now therefore take you 12 men out of the tribe of Israel, out of every tribe a man, and it shall come to pass, as soon as the soles of the feet of the priests that bear the ark of the Lord of all the earth, shall rest in the waters of Jordan, that the waters of Jordan shall be cut off from the waters that come down from above, and they shall stand upon an heap. And it came to pass, when the people removed from their tents to pass over Jordan, and the priests bearing the ark of the covenant before the people, and as they bear the ark, as they that bear the ark were come unto Jordan, and the feet of the priests that bear the ark were dipped in the brim of the water, for Jordan overfloweth all his banks all the time of harvest, that the waters which came from above stood and rose up upon a heap very far from the city Adam, that is beside Zaratan, and those that came down toward the sea of the plain, even the salt sea, failed and were cut off, and the people passed over right against Jericho. And the priests that bear the ark of the covenant of the tribes, the covenant of the Lord, stood firm on the dry ground in the midst of Jordan, and all the Israelites passed over on dry ground until all the people were passed clean over Jordan. We have two purposes given in this chapter for this miracle. Verse 7, as already pointed out, God was confirming his presence with Joshua in his leadership. He was confirming Joshua's calling to the people, and he did that with this miracle. He says, so that they may know that as I was with Moses, so I will be with thee. That's a promise that God made to Joshua several times throughout the book. In chapter 1, he made that promise to him initially, and then it's repeated. And God wanted the children of Israel to recognize that as well. And then verse 11, it says, behold, verse 10 is the one I wanted. And Joshua said, hereby ye shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will without fail drive out from before you the Canaanites, and so on. God wanted to show them this miracle so that they would know that his presence was with them and that his power was upon them. As they walked in faith and in obedience to him, God would be with them and the Canaanites would be driven out of the land. Joshua and the children of Israel here were facing the first external obstacle between them and the promised land. They had to cross a flooded river, before they could begin to take on the enemies and possess the land on the west side. Now, crossing the Jordan was no small undertaking. The Jordan is normally a fairly swift river. The current at a regular level moves at 4 to 5 miles per hour, which is fairly good clip for a river. And it's considerably faster when it's flooded. And its width varies from 100 yards to up to a mile across during flood stage. Exactly how wide it was here where the children of Israel were ready to cross, we don't know. But it does mention that it was at flood stage. And so the river was definitely a tremendous barrier between them and the land that God had called them to possess. And there was a tremendous multitude of people to get across that river. I did a little bit of calculation. Back in Numbers 26, God had commanded Moses to number all the men from 20 years and up who were able to go to war. And the total there was 601,730 men of war. Now that's just the men of war. Now assume that most of those men were married, and the number goes to 1,200,000 in approximate terms. So 1,200,000 with the men of war and their wives. Add just two children to each family, and the numbers go to 2,400,000 people. Then you add to that the Levites. There were 23,000 males alone in the tribe of Levi and their families, and they had taken 32,000 Midianite captives. Those were dispersed among the people. And so they had a tremendous amount of people to move across the Jordan. I wouldn't be surprised if the total would have been well in excess of 3 million. We don't know that for sure, but that would seem like a reasonable figure to me. Then there were all the possessions that they had as well, their cattle. We have no idea how many cattle they possessed prior to or at the time of leaving Egypt, but they had taken 808,000 head of cattle as spoil from the Midianites. And so I'm assuming that most of those were with them. So they could well have had in excess of 1 million, maybe considerably more, of livestock to take with them. And so if we think of that, 3 million people plus their livestock, their possessions, and so on, and all of these people need to get across the Jordan River to enter the land of Canaan that God has told them that they are to take. And the river's at flood stage. There's not a big bridge there that they can go across. And God says, you do what I say, and this is going to work out. You know, the children of Israel would have had prime opportunity to stall right there. You spread that many people out, and it takes time to move a group of people like that. I did a little bit of calculation. I figured if they formed lines 2 miles long, and each line had to move 3 miles to get from one campsite to the next, that's just a figure, assuming the river was perhaps a mile wide at that point. And you allow 30 seconds from the time one line starts moving till another line starts moving, and you're looking at 6.5-7 hours to get that amount of people across if they're going across in a column 2 miles wide. So it was no small undertaking that they faced. God chose to try their faith in him with something that demanded complete reliance on him. He said, the priests and the Levites take the ark, they step into the Jordan River, and I'll make a way. Now, that's not a reasonable thing for God to ask them to do. But God was there with a miraculous event to show them who he was and how special they were to him as his people, and to encourage them in the way that lay before them. God knew that later on they would be facing battles which would become increasingly hard. At Jericho, God did much of the battle for them, but later they had to put much more effort into it. And so God first put them in a situation that they were helpless to solve. And that, my friends, is often God's move in our lives as well. God will bring us into situations that we're helpless to solve to bring us to the realization that we're utterly dependent upon him. And I don't believe that we can enter the promised land correctly, using that in the figurative sense that we're speaking of tonight, without that realization of our utter dependence upon God, our need of his power, our need of his grace, and of a vibrant faith within him. And God has ways to bring us to a realization of realizations of our utter undoneness without his intervention in our lives. And further, as his children, God brings us into situations that teach us our ongoing dependence on him. God did this not only with the Israelites, but God did it with other men he used in the mightiest ways as well. Abraham was one of those men. Abraham was given that promise of a son in his old age. And Abraham got to the point where he decided to help out God. Sarah, his wife, encouraged him. And so we have the unfortunate situation with Hagar there. But it actually complicated the things that God was trying to accomplish. And Abraham had to come back to the place where, hey, this is completely in God's hands. I can't accomplish what God has promised. I need to let God do it in his way, in his time. Joseph, as a young man, had those dreams of being a ruler, of his family bowing to him. And God dashed those dreams for a period of time in Joseph's life. Sold as a slave into Egypt. And then, once things were going pretty well as a slave, betrayed, falsely accused, and thrown into prison. And then, forgotten by the butler for 2 years. But God had purposes in all of those things. God was, in part, I believe, bringing Joseph to the place where Joseph was not holding on to those dreams as his own thing anymore. They were in the hands of God. And also, there was valuable training for Joseph, especially in caring for Potiphar's estate and so on. Valuable training and preparation for the responsibilities that he had later when he became what we call the prime minister of Egypt. and overseeing the gathering of all that food. Moses is another example. When Moses was ready to lead the children of Israel, to deliver the children of Israel, God couldn't use him. And so God drove him into the wilderness until Moses got to the point where he said, I can't do it. We have Gideon gathered a sizable army, and God takes that army down to 300 men so that Gideon knows this is in God's hands. It's not in the Israelites' hands. We have the Apostle Paul expressing some of the same. In 2 Corinthians chapter 11, we have him talking about his thorn in the flesh and his desire to be rid of that. But God says to him that I'm not going to take this away because I want you to learn that my strength is made perfect in weakness. And Paul got to the point because of that, that he said, I rejoice in infirmities, in tribulations, in distresses, in persecutions, and so on. It was because he had come to recognize the hand of God in those things. Paul also experienced the aloneness that men of God must face at times. In 2 Timothy 4, verse 16, he said, all men forsook me, notwithstanding the Lord stood with me. All men forsook me, notwithstanding the Lord stood with me. And friends, I believe when we think we're ready for the battle, when we think we're ready to take Canaan, then we're not prepared. But when we come into these situations that God brings into our lives, and we allow him to show us that it's only by his power, only by his might, only by his spirit that his work is accomplished, then it lays the groundwork for us to move forward. And we're not moving forward on our own anymore. We're moving forward in his strength. And I believe that until we learn that God alone has the power, the wisdom, the understanding, the insight, the grace, and all the other things we need for all the situations we face in life, we will end up continually turning to the wrong sources. You know how it was with the children of Israel there in Egypt. God had showed himself to them many different times, and yet they would come up against it, and they would say, oh, this is the end. Why did you bring us into the wilderness to slay us? And when it was time to enter into Canaan the first time, and the 10 spies came back with the evil report, the children of Israel were, oh, this is the end of the road. Why are we here? That was because they were operating in their own strength rather than in faith in God. Now, as I'm saying these things about God isolating us in some sense of the word, I'm not in any way promoting individualism or pietism or pietistic look at life or anything like that, or some kind of self-righteous approach. What I am saying is that every one of us must come to the point, we must all face the Jordan River, so to speak, in our lives at some time or other, in order to understand our absolute dependence upon God. And I believe that short of that, we're going to fail to be partakers of the grace of God in the way that he wants us to. We need to come to the point where God is the first one we turn to, where there are things that happen because of our personal relationship with God, and we don't have to be continually propped up in order to stay on our feet, where we can be like David, who encouraged himself in the Lord his God when there was no one to encourage him. Remember that story where he and his men came back to their city. It had been burned. His men were ready to stone him. No one was there to encourage David. Jonathan wasn't even available at that point. And so it says David encouraged himself in the Lord his God. And friends, if we understand the nature of our God, if we understand the power of our God, if we understand the goodness of our God, the righteousness of our God, the holiness of our God, we will be able to encourage ourselves in the Lord even when we face situations that look utterly distressing and utterly desolate from a human perspective. And God was giving the children of Israel here a lesson in that as they prepared to enter into Canaan. And God will give us lessons in that as we enter into Canaan and as we pursue the expansion of his kingdom as well. We need to come to a place where we don't second-guess God's commands in difficult circumstances, but move forward with confident faith because we know in our hearts that God is true. We need to come to the place where we are willing and able to stand on our own two feet, leaving a true and clear testimony of God's grace upon us, where we recognize, as it says in Zechariah, "Not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, saith the Lord of hosts." Now, God had promised Joshua that he would be with him, and now it was time to put that faith to work, to step out in obedience and depend on God for the results. You know, the Israelites had a lot of manpower. We already talked about that, so I won't go into the details of that again. But imagine what it could have been like if the Israelites would have said, "No, this won't work. You don't cross a flooded river just by wading into it a little bit with an ark on the priest's shoulders." And they, according to history, there were a lot of trees in that area. Suppose that throng of men would have said, "Okay, we'll take these trees and we'll build us a bridge and we'll get across that way." Friends, they would have missed out on a glorious experience. And I doubt that it would have worked. I think God would have brought an end to something like that, just as he did with the Tower of Babel. But you know, sometimes when God brings us to those Jordan experiences, our tendency is to rely on manpower and miss out entirely on God's blessing as a result. If we cross the Jordan on manpower, we certainly aren't going to be effective against the Canaanites later. It's just not going to work that way. We need to move in faith with God. But if we let God bring us across, it helps prepare us for the battles that lie ahead. And friends, we are on the battlefield in our Christian lives. And I don't say that in a discouraging sense of the word, it's just reality. And we need a mighty God to see us through. We're up against an adversary who's greater than we are. But thankfully, greater is he that is in you than he that is in the world. And God has revealed that power in so many ways, and this is a lesson in relation to that. God also gave directions for the crossing. The priests and the Levites were to bear the Ark of the Covenant before the congregation this time. Usually that was carried in the midst of the congregation, but here God said, "Take the Ark of the Covenant ahead." And he told the people of Israel as well that they were to stand back at a distance. They were to maintain a distance of about 3,000 feet from the Ark of the Covenant. And I believe that was not only out of reverence, but also so that the people could see. And it mentions the fact here in verse 4, "that ye may know the way by which ye must go, for ye have not passed this way heretofore." So they could see where they were supposed to cross. So they could see where they were supposed to go. And obviously, with a crowd like that, it would take some distance in order for everyone to be able to see. But this was an occasion in which God was in a special way assuring the Israelites of his presence with them. They no longer had the cloud and the pillar of fire with them on a daily basis like they had in the wilderness. But in the extraordinary situation they faced, God gave them extraordinary assurance of his leading and his presence. And so as they maintained that distance, they were able to see that, yes, as the priest stepped into the water, all of a sudden, the waters upstream began to pile up higher and higher. That would be an amazing sight to see, especially a river at flood stage. I have often wondered how that looked. How high did the water pile up? And how long was the distance back to that city that it mentions here, that the waters stood up back to that point? And as they watched, God provided. And it says that throng of people, that vast multitude of people, were able to cross on dry ground. You know, God was here showing the people that he's a God who keeps his covenants. He's a God who keeps his promises. He had promised this land to Abraham's descendants years beforehand. And it might have crossed some people's minds, is God ever going to do this? And here we see God making the way for them to enter into that promised land. And that's such a blessing as we think of that. God's covenants can become a point of reference for us when all else in life seems obscure. When we're not sure how things are going to turn out. When we're not sure what the Lord is trying to accomplish in our lives and so on. The covenants of God stand as something sure. God proved his faithfulness again and again through the Old Testament to his people, and his covenants are just as sure today. The priests were to stand still in Jordan while the people were crossing. The ark wasn't going to move until the Israelites had passed through. And that's a lesson for us as well. God doesn't move in the middle of a situation. We don't have to fear that when we're in the middle of crossing Jordan, so to speak, that all of a sudden God's going to leave and a deluge of water is going to come down upon us. When we're walking with God in faith, when we're walking with God in obedience, God is going to be faithful to us. God is always faithful to those who are faithful to him. And so as the Ark of the Covenant didn't move, as the children of Israel were crossing, so God does not move away from his children as they cross the Jordan River. The blessing came with the obedience of the children of Israel. It took faith to literally step into the water according to God's command. It took faith on the part of the priests and Levites to do that. There was no prior physical evidence that God would stop the river's flow. And it's often that way when God is at work. The widow of Zarephath is an example of that. The prophet came to her and said, "You make me a cake." And and she said, "I only have enough for a meal for myself and my boy, and then we're going to die." And the prophet said, "You make me a cake first, and the meal is going to reach." You know, God calls us to take a step in faith where there's no prior evidence that he's going to perform what he said he will. The widow with the debt, who was to pay off the debt with the oil, the same thing happened. She had this little cruse of oil. I don't understand that it was any sizable amount. And the command was for her to take that and pour it into other people's vessels. So God often calls us to a place of commitment where we're willing to simply entrust everything to him. Where we're willing to let go of that last little bit that we have. And in spite of no evidence up to this point that God is going to work out this situation, if we respond in faith, if we're willing to step into Jordan, so to speak, God will honor that faith. God will honor that obedience. And so never fear that God will not perform, even when it's very difficult to yield all of those things to him. As we yield all in faith to God, he rewards our faith in ways beyond our expectations. And so as we think about these miracles that God has performed down through history, my desire is that we may recognize the power of God, that we may recognize God's provision for his people, that we may recognize God's faithfulness, and then that we may take to heart that the God of the people in the Old Testament, the God of the Old Testament saints, is the God of the New Testament saints. And he is your God as you know him through Jesus Christ. And that same power is available to us, to work within us, to expand the borders of his kingdom, to go forward in victory in our Christian lives, to be strong in him, to be overcomers, just as the children of Israel were against all the adversaries that they faced. And so may God bless you in your lives with courage, with faith, and with the fortitude to step out in obedience to him when you face the Jordans in your life. Shall we kneel together to pray?